This episode was made possible by our incredible patrons who faithfully support the work of amplifying the voices of spiritual abuse survivors. We are an extremely small team comprised of just two families with a passion for stories and image bearers. We committed early on to not monetizing any of the stories and rely solely on the donations of our Patreon community to operate. If you value this work and are able to contribute, you can join for as little as $5 a month. Another way you can support us is by following, rating, and reviewing the podcast. It only takes a moment, but it has a big impact on our reach. Thank you for daring to listen. Before we begin, we want to make the listener aware that this episode contains adult content related to abuse, sexual assault, and/or suicide. Listener discretion is advised.
This week, we have a two-part story from storytellers Aaron and Joyce. Today, we will be sharing Aaron's story. Aaron and Joyce met at a small Christian college in Indiana. They dated in college, left together, and would eventually get married. But while at this college, they both experienced the damaging fallout from the profoundly harmful satanic panic and purity culture crazes. Their stories, while heartbreaking, are also testaments to the stunning beauty and uniqueness of God's people. I'm Jay Coyle, and this is the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
I am all about blessed subtraction. There is a pile of dead bodies behind the Mars Hill bus. And by God's grace, it'll be a mountain by the time we're done. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop. You either get on the bus or you get run over by the bus. Those are the options. But the bus ain't gonna stop.
Before we begin, our storyteller Aaron wanted to recognize that the term Asperger's is no longer a diagnosis, but he does refer to it because it was his official diagnosis years ago. Thank you.
All right. Welcome, everybody. We are honored to bring you Aaron today and share his story about his childhood, growing up, and his time at Grace College and how that has impacted his life, his friendships, his faith. So we're really excited to have this conversation with Aaron. So Aaron, I want to welcome you to the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we get started, Aaron, I know there's something you want to kind of talk about yourself, and then we'll kind of jump right into your story.
Yeah, so I was not diagnosed as Asperger's until I was well in adulthood, but all of these incidences were influenced by that. And what I want to share is, as somebody who's on what we call the spectrum to neurodivergent, to be able to give our voice to things that we've experienced and how it's different than what we call an NT, which is neurotypical. But I do want to make it clear, I don't speak for everybody. There are many characteristics of Asperger's and the autism spectrum that not everybody has the same combination. Everybody's a unique individual. So by no means am I claiming to speak for everybody, just from my own experience.
Thank you for that. And we thank you too, just for your chance to share your story. It's a fascinating story, but it's also a heartbreaking story in many ways. So I'm really encouraged that you're willing to share. And I think it's going to really impact people that are listening to this. So I think to set your story up before we kind of get into your college years, it would be great to talk a little bit about your childhood. Specifically, you know, what was your childhood like? What church did you go to? What were your faith experiences like when you were growing up?
Yeah, certainly. So the incident that happened in college was a pivotal moment for me, but all of these things led up to that. So I started out really kind of in a difficult position because my father died when my mom was pregnant with me, and he's a newly ordained Baptist minister. He was a youth leader. He ran a summer camp for youth that was evangelical in nature. His personality was very outgoing. He was smiling all the time. He was an extrovert. Everybody loved him kind of thing. He was a star football player in a small town Midwest high school. he went on to college. He did play at college, but he wasn't a star there. But back at the hometown, he was like, he was a local hero kind of situation there. Then he was very spiritually, he very much exuded the fruit of the Spirit. And everybody was like, you know, you could tell that he loved God. He loved people. And he was a very charismatic individual. So he died in a tragic accident where that summer camp, they were on a trip to Canada, Algonquin Provincial Park in Ontario. And when they were there, a storm came up. They were canoeing and one of the canoes went over. The two guys in that canoe were struck. The one guy couldn't swim. So the other guy in the canoe, he was trying to save him. He couldn't. So my dad had already made it to the island, but he jumped back in trying to save those two. They all three ended up drowning. So he died a hero's death at 23. So here's this idolized individual that I'm supposed to be the heir to, which I'm not. I am an introvert. I'm an analytical thinker. I have a very, you know, being on the spectrum, I'm not that outgoing, you know, person. I exhibit my faith very differently. So the expectations set up for me, there's no way I was going to fulfill them. And what made it worse is everybody said, particularly the older I got, I looked like him. I was much taller, but I looked like him. Some people said I even walked like him. And in this small town too, my family was very well known. I mean, there's like, you know, 400 or 500 people. When I would go to that town, I would walk down the street. People would be like, "Oh, you're Donnie's son. You have to be. You're Dean's grandson. We know you. You look like it." People said I walk like him. I talk like him over the phone. I sounded like him. So I was this image of a person that I could never be. My mother did not react well at all to his death. So there were a lot of issues growing up because of that. She tried to put me into his place. She pushed me in that direction, which I'm just not that person. And so that set up a lot of pressures and issues that I just could not deal with. Part of that his death led me to a two church experience growing up. My mother went to a Grace Brethren church and my grandparents were Baptists. And now there's all kinds of flavors of Baptists. They were Northern Independent Baptists, definitely not Southern Baptists, but they were very outgoing. It was a very engaged church service. Everybody was brother or sister. You said, "Amen, preach it, brother." You know, it's like a very interactive church experience. The Grace Brethren was like stepping into the 16th century. It was very stoic. It felt a little bit like Jonathan Edwards' church in a sense, because it was driven by fear of hell. And you need to get your, literally they talked about it. There's even a track out there, get out of jail free card, you know, in Monopoly, they converted to get out of hell free.
Oh my gosh. Can you really quick explain what a tract is? Because they're tracts, right? With a T?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Tracts.
I grew up with, I feel like I had them when I was very young, but like, I don't think they exist still?
Yes, they do. We have a local independent fundamental Baptist church that leaves them everywhere. In fact, one of those cards showed up in a restaurant I went to of the get out of hell free card. So they're still doing it.
They're still really holding on to that Monopoly branding.
Yes, they are.
Can you explain what it is for listeners real quick?
So a track is it's like a miniature little comic book. It has like an illustrated story and it's supposed to get you to want to be saved. It's supposed to be evangelical in nature. The tracks that I experienced growing up, the Baptist church had a bunch of them in the back. And so I had a cousin who he was born the same year I was, and his father was my father's brother, the only brother. So his father kind of looked out for me. And so he and I grew up together. We literally spent the first 6 months of life in the same crib. So he and I would go, would hang out in the back, and we'd look at these tracks and make fun of them because the writing's bad. The stories are bad. And it's just, it's almost a little bit cheesy, but those tracks were, you know, it was a part of life.
Thank you. Sorry. I didn't mean to derail you. So,
oh no, not at all.
You're talking about the difference, like that there was, it was much more stoic, a little bit more Jonathan Edwards, like fear of hell driven when you went to the independent, right?
That was the Grace Brethren Church.
Oh, okay. Yep. That's it.
And I can't speak for everybody in the Grace Brethren Church, but that experience seemed to have replicated everybody that I knew that went to that kind of church. It's the same similar type of experience. You were allowed to exhibit fear. You were allowed to chuckle at the pastor's jokes as long as you didn't laugh too loudly. But other than that, emotion was forbidden in the church. You weren't supposed to do that. So I had that dichotomy there. Both were very hyper evangelical, but in different ways. The Baptist church was very much, I care about you. You're going to hell. I want to save you. I don't want you to go there. The Grace Brethren side was more, this is how it is, so you better get saved kind of thing. So very similar in theology, but very different applications. So I grew up with that conflict. And with my mother and my stepfather, who went to the Grace Brethren Church, my home life with religion was interesting because they acted very, very religious and pious in church. But as soon as we left, God was not a part of our life. There was no discussion really about God at home. There was no practical applications at all. We did pray at meals, but other than that, you know, no devotions, no, it was really, you really couldn't tell we were Christian, other than the fact we had that, I don't know if y'all remember this, but there was this picture of Jesus that everybody had in the 70s and 80s. It was up on everybody's wall. Nice white Jesus with the sort of looking upward with the glow on his face. You know, it's like, seemed like everybody had that picture at some point, but it was very much that reinforced the idea that salvation is about when you die, not about your life. But I had that opposite experience with the Baptists who it was all about your life. That created a bit of a conflict, but it was good because the Grace Brethren way didn't make sense to me. And while I had a lot of issues with the Baptist side too, at least I saw that they lived it, live what they believe. But those were my backgrounds. Both of the backgrounds, though, were funneled around eternal security. So once you're saved, you can never be unsaved. You can't leave. It kind of had a mafia feel at times. Once you're in, you can't get out. So yeah. It was very similar theologically. It's just the practice was different. I then also was sent to a Christian school. The Christian school was Grace Brethren with a tin of Baptists. There were a few Baptists on the board, but it was basically a Grace Brethren school. And that was extremely traumatic for me because they were the cruelest kids that I ever encountered. To give some background to this, it's a Midwestern, mid-sized city, not a big city, but it was industrial. All the factories, everybody worked at a factory. The neighborhood I grew up in was a very rough blue-collar neighborhood. Most of the families lived paycheck to paycheck. And so they had a bunch of kids. And so the neighborhood was pretty rough. There was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of vandalism kind of things. It just involved a lot of mischief and troublemaking. They were pretty cruel in their own way. I stuttered really badly at that time. So I got made fun of. I still fight the stutter today. The Christian school kids were just simply cruel. They were just mean. It wasn't because of their situation. I kind of understood even at the time that everybody's in a bad situation. So we're all acting out because I was too. But at the Christian school, it was like, you are supposed to be Christian, yet you are worse than the neighborhood kids. It was a situation where that stoic type artificial faith was then, that was the way to go there. The students that were held up as spiritual examples I knew what they did outside of the teachers. They were the worst kids. One of them in particular, he was a drug dealer. In fact, I ran into him selling drugs in the bathroom when I was in seventh grade, and he was going to be a missionary to the Bahamas, and everybody just praised him in that. But when he was with us, he said, yeah, he went there to drug traffic under the guise of being a missionary. And yet this was the guy that was held up as the example. Another student in my class, he was the straight A student. His dad was a voluntary custodian there, and he went in and he stole all the test keys. That's how he was getting straight A's. Yet he was held up as an example. So it was a very, to me, it was all hypocritical. Nobody lived their faith. It's all about appearance, which my mind had a hard time really processing. That was the environment there. So it was reinforced at school, home, and at church. One Sunday a month, I would be at my grandma's church. And so I had that Baptist influence in there that kind of balanced it out. So I could really feel like I'm not a participant. I'm an observer in those situations. That was the background that I went into in seventh grade, which was a pivotal year for me. In seventh grade, I had already been exposed to drug sales, and I started smoking a bit, not really that actively. I usually did it when I hung around some other kids. I started sort of going off the path because I really didn't understand this faith. To me, I have three settings. I have either I don't care about the issue at all, so I don't even want to talk about it. I have my analytical mode, where that's where kind of the Asperger's fits in, where I can detach myself from and just analyze it and be cerebral about it. And then the other setting is passionate. I get very emotional, I believe in it very strongly. So I act out, I get very passionate and emotional, which was not acceptable. So my faith then fell into that analytical mode that I couldn't get out of. So God to me was he was distant. He was there. I totally believed it. He wasn't really involved in my life. Then I had this experience where in the church setting, the youth pastor gave this Sunday school lesson where he explained what I come to understand is a very strict version of Calvinism, where God decided at the beginning of time who's going to be saved and who's going to hell. He drew these two boxes. I can picture it very much in my head, that there was this inside box. This was God's perfect will. This is what he wanted you to do. Then there was this outer box, that his permissive will, which he will allow you to go so far and then done. And he made a statement that really stuck with me. He said that if you are proven to be part of the elect, then you have been granted salvation and you can never lose it. Even if you want to get away from it, you can't. You're elect. There's nothing you can do to lose it. And that nothing you can do hit me, because I was this ADD kid that didn't fit in. And part of my spectrum issue was I talked a lot. I had no filter. So I was the kid that every parent-teacher conference, every report card up until my parents stopped going to them, was talks too much. It was every single one was talks too much. So I spoke up, and it was like, okay, so have I proven myself to be elect? And the pastor was like, without a doubt, you have proven yourself to be part of the elect. So my analytical mind is saying, if that's true, then I can do anything I want. I can literally do anything. So I don't even have to live like a Christian, because I'm in that kind of mentality where there was nothing I couldn't do. So I started to experiment further into these sinful behaviors, destructive behaviors, really. Also, then on the Baptist side of things, the people they held up with the greatest testimonies were the people that God rescued them from the most. So it was the drug addicted, the evil people had the great testimony. I had a boring testimony, you know? So it's like, well, I can kill two birds with one stone. I can go out and have a very, very vibrant testimony. And honestly, the opportunities were there. I mean, I carried a knife with me everywhere because it was a situation where, whether it was at school or in the neighborhood, a risk of a fight was very high, which ended up generating some PTSD later in life. But it was a situation where all the opportunities were there. There was a lot of occult type interest in the community. There was, you know, drugs. I could go to my back. I go in my backyard, and the guy that bordered my backyard, I literally cross a fence and I could get drugs. There was access to pretty much everything. So I had the opportunity. I had the green light to go ahead. So I did. I dove headfirst into all that stuff. And what I thought was, I'll just experiment with this stuff a little bit, enjoy life for a year or so, and then I'll come back. I have this great testimony, right? Well, it traps you. And I couldn't come back. And my family ignored that I was doing this stuff because it's appearance, right? It made my mom look bad. So just let's not talk about it. Just hide it. At church, it was like, well, you're just not behaving. You just need to act right. There was no concern that maybe I was struggling. Maybe I needed guidance. Maybe I needed somebody to show they actually cared about me instead of caring about me as the son of my father. And it got worse. And so I just kind of imploded to the point where I started having suicidal ideations. I just didn't know where to go. And this went on for, so all through junior high, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, the scariest moment in my life was I was sitting in Bible class, and this one guy who was a Grace Brethren pastor, he taught it for those 3 years, seventh, eighth, and ninth. He was somebody who grounded me during that whole time because he was Grace Brethren, but he challenged things. Like he would talk about things in the Bible that everybody was missing, at least everybody as far as the church went, you know, pointing out things like, when Jesus says that a tree can't bear more than one fruit, why do we have more than one fruit of the Spirit? Well, he explained to me the Greek grammar while Paul was writing and said that the fruit of the Spirit is actually love, and all these things define what love is. That's just one example of things that he shared with me, you know, the Greek origins, some of the context of things. And the analytical side of me loved it, and it just made sense. And I honestly, at a bit, I kind of felt a little arrogant because it's like, oh, I have this information that y'all are just missing, you know, and I'll confess that I was a bit arrogant with that. But he was somebody that grounded me and my only tie to faith at all in that whole time, because he was somebody who was genuine, but he knew my father. He was inspired to go into ministry because of his death. And so he had this kind of slanted view of me because of that background, but he provided direction and things that I was interested in in the Bible, that now things were starting to make sense. But then he scared me to death, because one time in class, and I will never forget this, he was going over Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews 6 verses 4-6 talks about people who've once been enlightened and have tasted of the Holy Spirit, all that kind of stuff. Once they fall away, they can't be renewed until repentance. And he, being this eternal security individual, he said, I honestly don't know what to do with this. And I was like, well, time out. What do you mean you don't know what to do with this? And he said that this doesn't fit with our theology. I don't know how to answer this, because he said, you can't say that that person was not saved, based on the description there. And I went into a tailspin, because it's like, hey, I'm doing all this stuff because y'all promised me that I'm going to heaven no matter what, and now you're throwing this at me? At that point, then I trusted no one of faith ever, because I'm going off of what I believe and what I think, because I felt betrayed because I made these decisions. Granted, they were stupid decisions, but they were decisions nonetheless based on what you were telling me. And now that's not true. So where does that leave me?
It sounds like you don't make decisions without being informed. Like that is very much a part. You're like, I made an informed decision. It might not have been a good decision, but it was informed. And now you're telling me the information was wrong. And now Absolutely. I've already made the decision. That makes sense.
Absolutely. And that analytical mind is, which is what makes me good at my profession now, that I did. I made decisions based off of evidence that I was given. And now you're presenting me contrary evidence and I'm betting my eternal soul on this. So that was a big deal. So long story short, not so short, but by the time I got to the summer of my junior year, another pastor had come into my life. He too knew my dad as a kid and he went into ministry because of him. And I met all these people who said that too, which later in life, I sort of questioned some things about that. But he took the time. He showed me he cared. He had a lot of flaws that I saw, but he really showed genuine concern for me. We went on a mission trip out to California. I grew up in Ohio, so we went across country and went into Mexico. And I saw people who literally had tin siding from a house, pieces of tin that they set up as a hut. They literally couldn't stand in it. That's what they were living in. And seeing that we were so spoiled and so out of touch with what real people are suffering, that brought me back to that shook me out of myself. And I don't know what word to use here. I don't like the word rededicated, but that's what they called it. But basically, I looked at it as I was the prodigal son, literally, and I decided to get out of the pigsty and I'm coming home. That was my coming home moment. The analytical side of me said, okay, if I'm going to be a committed Christian, the only people I know in my life that are in ministry. So I have to go into ministry. And so I mistook that for being called into ministry. And later on, I figured out that pastor had been grooming me to be a minister all along. He was pushing, and I thought back all these little subtle things he was doing, kind of pushing me in that direction. But I'm not suited for ministry. I could be a theologian possibly, but I'm not the people person. I'm not the person that you want at your bedside if you're sick, you know. And, you know, I could argue theology from when I started doing that when I was 10, because to me, I could put together things, but being a pastor was not me. But that decision caused me then to say, I was looking at Wright State University and a couple of others. And going in a direction in computer science and a few other things. But at that moment, then I knew I had to go to Grace College because that was where I had several uncles and aunts that had gone there and my pastors had all gone there. So if I'm going to go into ministry, this is where I need to go. And they had this streamlined program at the time where as an undergrad, you would take all of your biblical languages, Greek and Hebrew, so that when you got to seminary, you cut a whole year off of seminary. I went in that streamlined program. So that's what got me there. Had I not had that understanding of things, I would have never gone to Grace College. That set me on a very different path. When I got there, I should back up a minute. I left the Christian school when I was in ninth grade. I got myself literally kicked out. I said, if my parents aren't going to let me go to public school, I'm going to force them to because I'm going to get kicked out. And finally, the principal, who again was another guy who knew my dad, that he said, look, Aaron, I know what you're trying to do. I think it's a bad decision, but look, I will support you going to the public school. In fact, I'll even let you do a visit. And he talked to my parents, and so he said, fine, you know, give it up. So I went to the public school, and I actually had a much better experience there, and I got more grounded, and I had a much better faith experience. But now I'm going back into a Christian school environment, and I was not prepared for that.
Do you feel like you had a better experience because for you it made more sense? You're like, okay, these people aren't claiming to be Christians. So they can do whatever they want. And like, it makes sense. Do you feel like that played into that for you?
Absolutely. And the other thing I found out is that there were Christians in a public school. Believe, you know, imagine that. We had some Hindu kids that went to that school. They were nice kids. You know, they weren't these evil people that I've been told. I went there with Catholic kids, which in the Christian school, Catholics and charismatics were evil.
Yep. I was taught that like the Antichrist was coming from the Catholic Church, probably.
Exactly. The Pope was going to be the Antichrist. Yes.
No offense to Catholic listeners. I do not believe that anymore, but I was taught that when I was younger.
I actually went from a public school in junior high and middle school to a private school, like my last year of junior high, all the way through high school. And my high school was super small. And one of the things that I found interesting was when I went to a private school, like if you were overly religious or into your faith, like that was almost perceived as like not cool. But like in public school, again, not everybody cared, but it didn't seem like that was like a, like you could be anything like in public school. I do remember though in public school, like, and I'm dating myself, we used to have these prayer by the pole or rally around the flag. I forgot what they call it, where you'd sit and you'd line up before school and you'd pray to the...
It's like the National Day of Prayer, right?
I don't know what it is. They had a name for it and I'm blanking out on the name, but all I remember is I would do it and I would wear a Christian t-shirt, which was kind of... which Christian t-shirts are embarrassing. I'm sorry. I'm just going to say that out loud. They're embarrassing.
Yes, they are.
But they were the thing, right?
I don't know why we need Christian t-shirts. I'm just being honest. But you would have to wear your Christian t-shirt and pray around the flag, which is odd to me now looking back that one, A, at a public school, we were allowed to do that. Two, why in the world were we praying around the freaking flag, the U.S. flag, all of us?
Exactly.
But I do remember in public school, there's like 10 people that did it. And that was embarrassing because you're in like middle school, and I went to a big middle school, and there's like 10 of us around this stupid, like the American flag. We looked like idiots with our Christian Jesus fish shirts on. So anyways, but I was going to say, like, besides that, like, I do remember when I went to private school, like if you were really, you know, if you're trying to be faithful to your, not always, but that was kind of perceived as like, could be perceived as like, oh, that's not cool. Like, you know, you're in a Christian school. Why are you doing this? Like, why are you following this stuff? So anyway, so I understand your feeling when you say, Aaron, that was almost like you had a relief when you went to public school where you could just be yourself. Because I definitely understand that, where you're coming from there.
Yeah, and you're right. Every time I tried to change, I couldn't at the Christian school because I was labeled the rebel. I was the one listening to heavy metal. I was the one that had very colorful adjectives and expletives that I used quite frequently. So I was seen as the bad kid, and there's nothing I could do to change that. When I went to public school, oh, there were a lot of kids worse than me. So it was a very, very different feel. And you're right. I could feel like I can make myself into whatever I want to be. I had the freedom to do that.
So you graduate from public school and then you decide to go to Grace. And Grace College is, I'm actually on their website right now. They're in Indiana. They talk about where they are in Indiana, which I'm not aware of that city, but it seems like it's a small town. So it's a small town. Is that correct? Okay, cool.
Yep.
So,
yep.
You know, you decide to go to Grace and you get to Grace. What was the culture like there? What was like when you arrive on the campus at Grace, what was kind of your initial thought of everything you were seeing and the people you were meeting?
So when I got there, I was given a heads up by people who had gone there before. This is what to expect. They have the freshman hazing week, which, again, I don't see how that's consistent, but I sort of knew what some of the environment should be, but when I actually got there, it was kind of eye-opening. It almost like I reverted back to junior high school where these kids were very isolated. They were very tunnel vision kind of outlook on life, and then I found theologically, they really didn't understand their own faith. That was a bit of a shock to me. I was, again, sort of now top of the totem pole as far as theology, because I could talk about, you know, even very abstract theological concepts with my professors. And being on the spectrum, that's one of the things that, you know, we're very good at certain things. Theology was one of those things. I could understand concepts that a lot of the neurotypicals and NTs really couldn't conceive it, because in my mind, I see things completely differently than a neurotypical person does. I conceive of things differently, which is a big problem, because in my relationships, when I'm trying to interact with somebody, I'm picturing something completely different in my head than what's coming out of my mouth. So I could conceive of things, but when it comes out of my mouth, sometimes, unless I prepare for it and really kind of work through it, it can come across very differently. But the one thing that I saw was the same attitude of, we're all pious, good Christians, but we're not. And it's like, you either believe it or you don't. If you're not acting it out, then you don't believe it, to me. When I got thrown in that environment, then some of my PTSD kicked in, because they had these things called a boogie pile, where somebody would jump on somebody else and then everybody else would jump on them, and you'd have this big pile of bodies. To me, I had this, I don't know if it's a phobia, a reaction or whatever, but I can't be in a situation where I cannot escape. It's not claustrophobia. It's the idea of, I can't escape, because I had some traumatic incidences as a kid, and that just really triggered it. And so my questioning of everything then really kicked into high gear, because why are we doing this? And then that came over to, we had to have these meetings in our hall, our dorm. And they were a total waste of time. They were in there talking about sports and talking about music or girls, which is okay, but I really don't want to hang around with y'all. No offense, but you're not the people I'd want to have these conversations with. And so I was literally questioning everything. And theologically, then it became an issue, because I challenged the whole their view of what predestination was, challenged the concepts. I remember being in class and the professor was talking about all the children and the babies who were slaughtered in the land of Canaan, and, you know, what happened to them. And even in my church, it was like, well, until you reach the age of accountability, then God's not going to send you to hell. And one of the students actually said, well, it depends on what they were predestined. If they were predestined to hell, then they would have been sent to hell. And even the professor was shocked by that. But that was a prevailing attitude. So to me, that had to be taught. That's what was reinforced in churches. I could not conceive of God creating people specifically to die in hell. That he created you with no options. I'm creating you as an individual in my image, but I'm going to force you to go to hell.
And is grace because that's a very, I don't know from a theology standpoint, that's definitely something that's taught within Calvinism for sure. So I don't know where else that's taught. I would say mm-hmm. More fundamental, but that may be wrong as well. Was grace affiliated with a specific church or a specific denomination?
It was, well, they've split several times, but at the time it was part of the Grace Brethren denomination. It was their seminary, their church, the church's seminary college.
Yeah. And anytime you talk about like predestination, specifically when it comes to people's internal salvations, and you're dealing with individuals, at least this is my opinion, in organizations or churches where that is kind of like a red line for them, like you can't cross it, like you got to believe it. Anytime you question that, in my opinion, it does produce quite a bit of anger or frustration on those individual sides, because it's like they want you to believe it so badly. And I personally have always felt the reason they want you to believe it so badly, again, this is Jay speaking, is because if they start to question that, then they may have to question other things too. And like, everything. Like that's my been yeah. always my opinion whenever that conversations come up. And like, I always kind of, and I don't know if you're this way, Aaron, too. Like, if you want to believe that, like, I'm like, okay, you can believe that. I just don't. But then that seems to like ignite this right. other level of like kind of frustration where they start turning the Bible frantically and showing you verses and things like that. So I can sense that tension that you probably felt by just raising the question or saying like, hey, I don't believe that. I mean, it was tense, right? The reaction would be tense if you questioned that. Yeah.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I that's the impression that I got is that their belief was if you question one thing, you're questioning everything. If you question one passage of scripture, then, well, why is any of it valid? And to me, that's illogical that there can be things that even a broken clock is right twice a day. So just because there's something that I question doesn't mean that I'm throwing everything out. They couldn't conceive of that. So that was me coming in. And then it only got worse from there because my RA, he had, I don't know what his deal was. I don't know if he just thought I was a rebel, if he thought I was a threat or just didn't like me. I don't know, but he singled me out. What I didn't realize at the time was I was suffering from PTSD from my childhood and teenage years. But to me, that didn't exist for it because I wasn't in the military. I didn't go to war. So that's not me. And so I started struggling with these things. Being on the spectrum too, there are certain things that I don't care about. Other things, they have to be that way. So I had my CDs in alphabetical order by group and by chronology, and my roommate would mess that up. And it would really irritate me. And if I haven't gotten enough sleep, whatever, I reacted very strongly to very minor things. And so that began to be question of, I must have an anger problem, that there's something not right with me. So I was talking to my RA because he would come to me and say, you know, I'm here to help counsel you. I went to my professors too, to talk about some things. Cause I did experience a lot of, I would say now traumatic. I wouldn't have described them at the time as traumatic, but I saw a lot of things that these Christian school isolated kids never saw or experienced. And when I started talking about them, instead of trying to help me through it, they then saw that, oh, I dabbled in evil stuff. I experimented with things. I'm a threat now, particularly since I'm questioning theology as well. And my RA just sort of latched onto that for whatever reason. And then he would push on some of the things. And there were some things that I did or knew of or witnessed that were not necessarily legal. So he would push on those things. And then after I'd get done telling him, he'd go, well, I'm going to call the sheriff of your town and I'm going to tell him about that. I'm going to turn you in. Like, turn me in for what? It seemed like he started trying to trap me. One of these things, I don't know how it started, but it got out of control pretty quickly. But in my hometown in the 80s, there was activity of some sort of cult that was going on. They would find sacrificed animals in the woods with, they would draw a pentagram with their blood, you know, all that kind of stuff. I don't know if it was real or if some kids were just demented kids that wanted them to think of it. I think every place in America has this legend, but there was a legend of Mary Jane, who was a witch that was burned. And there's this tree in the woods where it's dead, but it doesn't die. And that's where she is. So, you know, stupid high school kids would go out there drinking, trying Mary Jane's tree, you know, and I went out there once.
This was like during like satanic panic in the whole country, right?
Yeah, that was really starting to ramp up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, my church talked about it. You know, there's evil everywhere. And to me, I knew some people who were trying to get into that kind of thing. What I knew was that Satan worship was not what these conservative evangelicals were saying it was. True Satan worship was about obtaining power for yourself. And it's not like they somehow thought of it as church just replacing Satan for God. And so you think of going to church. Well, now you're going to a satanic church versus, no, that's not how it is at all. Satanism is about indulging in yourself and doing what you want to do and things. And I saw people who were really pursuing that. And so when the church was talking about it, it's like, no, that's not right. Again, I don't know how this stuff started, but I did mention about Mary Jane's grave and all this other stuff. At Grace College at the time, it was really hitting a peak with Frank Peretti and his books, and everybody was getting into this. And so when I would question things, they looked at it as, oh, I had exposure to this. I must be a Satanist. That's where they went. And somehow it just continued to escalate. And I didn't realize that was going on, because to me, I found it kind of humorous of how naive some people were. So I didn't take it very seriously. Apparently it was being talked about because somebody came to me and said, I heard that you were the leader of a witch's coven back home. On campus, somebody came to me and said that. And I found out that people were talking about that. I literally had no idea where that came from. My reaction to it, I laughed, because it's like, you can't be serious. Apparently they were. And so I don't know, again, how this rumor started or how it was going, but everybody's reading Frank Peretti. Everybody was seeing demons everywhere. And then they had a spiritual emphasis week where that was the emphasis, was Frank Peretti's This Present Darkness. And so everybody is really getting into this kind of mentality, this fear. I had started a relationship with who would become my wife. She was working through her own trauma at the time. We were starting to move too fast. And she said, you know, I do want this relationship, but we have to slow down. I have to work through things. You need to work through things. So let's slow it down. And I felt very good about that conversation. I felt that being on the spectrum, I'm not good at relationships, and I am not smooth. I'm not somebody who can really pick up subtleties and things of that nature, particularly then. I'm better at it now, but at the time, I had no clue. So her telling me directly, this is where I'm at, was, first of all, nobody's ever done that before. Everybody always plays games. But the fact that she did that, I felt very good. Hey, this is where we, you know, relationship, this is where we need to head. So I go back to my dorm. I'm on a high. I think this is great. Then her friend grew up in the same hometown that I did. And her family knew my family. I didn't really know her, but there was a connection there. And she's the one that called me up that night. And I do want to say that what I'm about to say may be triggering to some people. So back on in my dorm, then I get a call, and I was asleep for maybe half an hour or so, which is the worst time for me to wake up because I'm very disoriented if I just fall asleep and get woken up. And I was kind of disoriented. I grabbed the phone on the wall, didn't turn on any lights in the room, so everything's dark. She then lays into me, saying that I put a spell on my wife. Her name's Joyce. I'm going to call her Joyce because in that context, that's who it was. It wasn't my wife at the time. It kind of feels weird calling her that. That I put a hex on, a curse or a hex or spell on her. And I'll be honest. Some of the details of the call, it's been a long time ago. And honestly, at a certain point, I just stopped listening because I was just in shock.
Yeah.
So I put some sort of spell on her. She's having this meltdown and it's my fault. She accused me of raping her earlier in the evening. And that's why she's having this meltdown. She's going to call the dean, and the dean's wife was coming over, and I'm going to be in trouble. I'm going to get arrested. And at that point, I'm just totally stunned. And so I don't know how long the call went on. I don't know what else she said at that point, because it just really, I was in a state of shock. And so I'm expecting any moment for the police to show up. I'm going to be taken out in handcuffs, which, again, part of my PTSD is I don't want to be in a situation where I can't escape from. The idea of going to prison was, it was panicky for me. in that sense. And so I don't really recall the rest of the night, but I woke up the next morning. I couldn't talk to her. I didn't know what she told him. And I didn't know her. I've only known her for like a month or two at that point. So I don't know what she's saying. I don't know what's going on. And so I'm in this situation where I'm being accused of being a leader of a coven. I had put a spell on her. I was being accused of something to me was one of the most heinous crimes a person could commit. And now I'm being put into that category. And then my RA, and again, I can't remember the exact timeline of things, so I might get a few things mixed up, but my RA came to my door and he told me that he'd gotten a call because I guess our mutual friend had called him too and said that, I can't remember if he said that I was accused of or that I did rape Joyce. And he said it loud, and I'm sure he did it on purpose. All the guys were in the hall because it's before class. Everybody's getting ready. Everybody heard it. I then, at that point, went from being shocked to my defense mode growing up, because I got picked on all the time, is that I found that if I stood firm and I yell back and I get in your face, most of the time they're going to back down. So I went into that mode again and I got into his face. I started yelling at him and I said that I want to talk to the dean now if he's accusing me of this, because my RA led me to believe that the dean he said that I'm going to have to go before the dean and explain what happened. And I'm going to have to explain myself. So he very much implied that the dean was going to pursue that action and that he was accusing me of this. I went into aggressive mode and I was, it's that, look, if all this stuff is going around campus, then I'm going to now speak up for myself, because this is not a joke anymore. This is not something that is to be taken lightly. Now there are major accusations. It's all around campus. It just got out of control. And
what were you thinking? Like, were you concerned about Joyce at this point too?
Absolutely. Because this may seem a little cheesy, but I was in love with her at that point. It was one of those things where I literally thought about her all the time. We had only known each other for a short time, but I knew there was something special about her. I really loved her in the full capacity that I was capable of loving a person. To know that she's going through something that I don't know what it is, and I don't know what she's saying. And obviously, if she had a meltdown, there's something seriously wrong here.
Yeah.
I couldn't do anything. I couldn't talk to her. And the campus, then the dean put an order down that we were not allowed to talk to each other. We weren't allowed to see each other. We weren't allowed to have phone conversations, nothing. Total silence. So again, I don't know what's going on her side. All I know is that my RA is telling me that I'm going to have to go before the dean to answer these accusations, that I have done something heinously wrong and everybody's talking about it. There's no confidentiality. And then everything that I had said to him in confidence, said to my professor in confidence, all came out and was twisted and used to build a case against me. And I just couldn't believe this stuff was happening. It just, for 3 whole days, they banned full contact. So during this time, I don't know what's going on. I had forgotten. My wife had reminded me the other day that she did go to her friend's house. One of her friend's mom taught at the school. So they live locally. So she went to her house. Her friend then called me. So again, this is part of the spectrum thing. It's a technicality, right? So the rule was she couldn't call me. I couldn't call her, but the friend called me and she was there. So she was able to tell me that, look, you know, to paraphrase, that this is not true. This is not what I'm saying. This is out of control. And so at that point I knew at least she was okay. And that it was truly a fabricated situation, which part of me felt good. And then the other part of me was like, who was really doing this? Who was trying to create this situation? But all of that being said and done, what that did was, is that when we were allowed, which again, it drives me nuts because I was an adult. I should not be prohibited from seeing somebody absent a, it still baffles me that happened, but we had to be supervised. This is the part that I find very ironic, and I don't want to disparage anybody, but they came from Bob Jones University. It was a couple, and they weren't even allowed to touch each other. They weren't allowed to walk on the same sidewalks together. And they're giving us relationship advice while in college. And I just found that to be, it was just another piece in this barrier that was being built. And so we had these supervised visits, but what happened is that everybody abandoned Joyce on her side. I was already alone and I was fighting against things. And when I left home, I like really left home. I had no emotional connection there. So I was really alone. So who did we have? We had each other. We were then pushed together in a very unhealthy way because she had a lot to work through that she knew she had to work through. I had tons of stuff to work through that I didn't even know I had to work through it because it just didn't register with me at the time. But all we had were each other. And so we got meshed into this pressure situation where we only had each other and we developed immediately this codependent relationship. We didn't fix what we needed to fix in ourselves. We ended up getting married very quickly after that, which I'll admit in hindsight was a bad decision. We should have healed ourselves first and then come together. That's what happened.
So you have this like pretty intense accusation against you. How did that go away? Did people just stop caring? Or was she able to like say, hey, this isn't true. Why are you guys saying this?
So the resolution that was, I did have to go before the dean, and there was the dean of students there too. I don't remember his name either, but I had to apologize for falsely accusing the dean publicly because, so my RA told me that I had to answer to the dean for assaulting Joyce. So I said, I am being accused of this. I have to go before the dean. And, you know, being angry and being adrenaline pumped, sure, I had said that the dean is accusing me because I generally believe that based on what I was being told. And he said, and when I talked to the dean, he's like, I didn't know any of this was going on. He said, my wife went to the dorm. She knew Joyce was distressed. She helped her. So I responded to the accusations against me, which turned it into a conflicting story. So in his mind, he's like, okay, this is, you know, okay, we had an incident, it's done. And now he sees me as the bad guy because I'm the one throwing accusations around. And so there was nothing said about what I was being accused of, about what the rest of the campus was doing, which if I did it, for some reason, me doing it was wrong, but everybody else could do it. Right. And I actually had evidence to say what I had to say. They were literally gossiping.
So all of those accusations were all happening in a peer-to-peer space. So it's all the students are building up this case, it sounds like, that you had assaulted yeah. Joyce, that you had put a spell on her. So it's just like this wild, uncontrolled gossip that's yeah. completely destroying lives. And you're being told that the dean believes this. You're not allowed to talk to Joyce, so you have no idea if she believes this even. And
right.
you're brought before the dean to apologize to him.
Yes.
And then the dean acts like he doesn't know what you're talking about.
Right. He said, where did this yeah. even come from? I said no such thing. I told him where it came from, and yeah. he said that I was lying. That no, he didn't say that. I don't like using this term, but being on the spectrum, you do feel gaslighted most of your life because you're seeing things differently than everybody else and you're being told you're wrong. This situation, I was so disoriented because this isn't even close to reality. None of this stuff is even close. And I'm just like, what is going on?
Now, when you were diagnosed with being neurodivergent, was this before that or were you aware of that diagnosis when you were in college?
I was not aware of it at all. Our idea of being neurodivergent was Rain Man. That's the only exposure we had. And my mother was very, I'm not sure why. I don't know if she, encountered somebody like this or not, but she was very much, we don't talk about that, about this neurodivergent stuff at all, which we didn't call it that then. But ironically, I was diagnosed when I was getting help for my son, who's neurodivergent. And when we were in with the counselor, she was a doctor, but I was in with her and I was saying, oh yeah, well, that's me. And oh yeah, that's, yeah, I have the same thing. You must've gotten it from me. And she had like 9 criteria for being on there. And if you get half for more, that was the diagnosis. I had 6 of the 9 characteristics. And so it was much later then that I was diagnosed. But then looking back, it's obvious in the family, but going back further, you could see it in my grandfather. You could see it from stories I've heard, like my great-great-grandfather had memorized the entire King James Bible. He could quote you, you tell him Samuel, 1 Samuel 5:12, he could tell you what that is. Okay. So this probably goes back several generations. In hindsight, it makes a lot of sense, but at the time, I just knew this is how I was.
Because I don't know the answer to this, but especially back then, 30 years ago, how was a school like that, if they were aware of a diagnosis like something like neurodivergence, how would they handle that in these types of situations, understanding that you process information differently? Like, I guess what I was trying to get to is like, what were we like back then, knowing that people processed information differently, especially if they have something like, and I apologize, it's ND, correct? That's the correct acronym for it, ND?
Yeah.
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 And like, how was it back then compared to how is it today? Like, are we more acceptable? Do we have more understanding to say people will process that information differently and we need to take that into consideration? And I just didn't know if this experience, if that was even... that conversation was even present, knowing now that it wasn't, you know, without that type of understanding, it does seem like, at least when you're telling this story, that the dean had the ability to like enter into that conversation to gather more factual details versus just saying, hey, Aaron, like, this is on you, not on me. Like, when you're telling it, it makes you seem like the dean may have said, like, why are you even bringing up this up to me? What have you done? Is that what it felt like?
Yeah, absolutely. Because fact finding was not, that wasn't on the table. It was, this is what we know. And so there's nothing to find because we know the facts. This is it. And one of the things that I really have only come to grips in the last couple of years is that I really can't communicate the depth of things that are in my head. I see things that I can't describe. And so not being able to express that clearly and concisely then definitely exacerbated the problem because everything was a biblical counseling. There was no real, some people may have acknowledged there's some mental illness, but that's not from God. So everything is in the spiritual context, and they combined my reactions and how I was as a person with my questioning of what they were doing. They saw it as I'm just rebellious. I have not an evil heart, but a heart not after God. I'm not trying to find the truth. I'm trying to bring deception and dissension to the body of Christ. And that kind of accusation. And it was like, so there was no discussion. There was no, what's your side of the story? What do you recall happening? Let's hear what you have to say. And nobody else was rebuked at all in this whole process. The person who accused me of it was, nothing happened to her. My RA, who totally abused his power, violated confidentiality, clearly, I mean, being in the legal profession now, I was like, oh, I've got a case against it. You know, it's like, I'm thinking of all the things that went wrong and nothing happened. I was the only person who had to apologize out of this whole thing. And I felt just like, I honestly did it because partially I knew I did say that he accused me and that was factually incorrect. I could do that in my mind because yes, that was factually incorrect. And I said something, even though I believed it to be true and I had reason to believe it, it was factually incorrect. So I will set the record straight on that. it reinforced to me that organized Christianity is broken. It has no resemblance to what Jesus actually taught, and that I don't have a place in this. Yeah. I just really don't.
It sounds like that was very traumatic in itself. Just that instance isolated on its own. Did you guys have any support system? Like, clearly Joyce isn't okay. If she's, it sounds like a panic attack of some sorts.
Yeah, it was. It was absolutely a panic attack. Yeah.
And it sounds like it was brought on by the fact that she was being disciplined.
Yeah. And that nobody was believing her. Nobody would listen mm-hmm. to her side of the story. And that was her, that was part of her trauma, is that nobody listened to her. Nobody took that seriously. So it was very traumatic. And her dad was understanding in the fact that he did not believe what was said. He believed when she told him, "Dad, this is what happened," he believed her. That was a pretty isolated situation. And when we left Grace College, we were engaged and we went to Alabama, which is pretty far away from Indiana. She had a brother down there who was able to set us up with an accommodation. We went to Jacksonville State University down there, which was a great, I'll be honest, it was a great university, great experience, but we were then even more isolated because we didn't know anybody. We had to build a circle of friends. You can't separate her and I because we were codependent. And so all the friends were together, all the situations were together. Now she was in a very different major than I, and there were some friends there, and it wasn't two people coming together. It was two people that were mushed together, and there was a mess that created it. And honestly, that disastrous setup, it still is with us today, to be honest, because we never did get the healing we wanted to do. Faith-wise, I was going on a path that would lead me to what I guess people now call deconstructing. We didn't have that term back then, but I literally took apart everything, all the theology, and I started building my own. But then we ended up going to a Mennonite church when we were, after we were married. This was a few years after we were out of college by that point. And there were some people I very much respected who were in that church. I respected her dad. Her dad was a great man, and he was a minister. I learned a lot from him, but he was part of this. So this must be a good faith because he's a part of this. And I knew there were a lot of flaws there. And I didn't really adhere to a lot of the Anabaptist principles, but this was a good church. This wasn't her dad's church, by the way. This is a different one, but her background was in this, and there were some good things about that. So we got in there, but I was then told patriarchy.
Even at the Mennonite church, you were told that? There was very
That was
emphasis on
very, very patriarchal. I mean, to the point where the women did the sewing circles. In fact, one of the elder, I was an elder for a period of time. One of the other elders' wives were appalled that Joyce would teach junior high school kids because women can't teach men, even though she taught at a Christian school and she taught Bible, you know, 5 days a week. For some, you know, in church, that's just wrong. One time I wasn't at a meeting and somebody said something that was very, very off, not even close. And she was going to say something, but she didn't. So she talked to one of the pastors afterwards who they were childhood friends. And she said, "I was going to say something, but decided not to." And he said, "Well, that's good because your husband wasn't here." It was extremely patriarchal. And the only reason why we went there at all is because they said they were trying to get away from a lot of the practices of Mennonite and go to the heart of it, which is compassion and helping people. And what we saw was over time, the practices eventually just crept back in. And there were other incidences that really, I don't think we need to go into here, but there was a series of things that they kept advising me that it's my responsibility. I'm responsible for my wife and my kids. So I need to lay down the law. I have to make the decisions. And that's not me. I honestly was a feminist from when I was a kid. My first boss was a woman. I feel very comfortable under female leadership. To me, it doesn't matter as long as you're good. And I've had a lot of incompetent male leadership over me. I can tell you that. It really went against what I thought was right. Being on the spectrum, you're outside. Okay. And it's like, well, if everybody else says this is true, then I must be wrong. And so I bought into that and made our marriage worse. We had issues with trying to deal with a special needs child that we didn't know how to handle. I'll be honest with that. He's a great kid and he's a great adult, and he's really a light amongst people. He's a very compassionate guy, but as a kid, we didn't know how to handle it. There's no manual on it. And all we were told is, well, we're not disciplining our kid enough. We need to spank him. We need to, you know, punish. And you don't do that to a neurodivergent person, because all we don't see that as, okay, well, we need to correct the action. We see that we're being punished because we're doing what we think is right. We're doing what we're protecting ourselves. We're doing, we may not even understand it, but so we definitely don't understand why we're being punished. And so that just made things a lot worse. And we ended up getting to the point where we got divorced because we were so far apart. We were so broken that we needed to separate to start working on ourselves. And then we ended up coming back together, but it unfortunately led to that divorce. And even now, where a lot of things are making sense for me, both of us are very active in justice work. She's very active in the survivor community. We're now being free to be who we are spiritually, but it's still, we have this legacy this trail of bodies behind the bus for, you know, in our life, that it's just really kind of, it's kind of frustrating to look back on to see what all's happened. And all of that was really, it goes back to that one incident, because that is what set us on a path that we have not been able to get off of.
And no one ever came back and apologized to either. Did anybody ever come back and apologize to either of you from the church? Not from the church, I'm sorry, from the school or anyone, any of the friends?
So the friend that accused me, she did apologize to Joyce. She never apologized to me, but she did apologize to Joyce. But as far as I know, that was the only one.
That's heartbreaking.
It is. And which, you know, when you add everything up from the church experience, the elementary, junior high experience, the college experience, I just, faith, organized religion to me was really, it reinforced to me with my analytical mind that this is illogical, that we have to baptize somebody three times forward, or it's not a real baptism, because if you weren't baptized that way, you'd have to be rebaptized in that church. Why do you have to wear a suit to church? I mean, even that doesn't make sense to me. That if this is a faith of they kept emphasizing it's a personal relationship with God, then if it's a personal relationship, why do I have to conform to all this stuff? It just really created a great conflict for most of my life, which is why I was miserable, which is why I made my family miserable. I really had a barrier between me and God, because what I believed I was told was wrong. And when we did that separation, and I really fully deconstructed, to use that term. I don't really use that term myself, but I know that's how people would define it. Now in a place where I'm very comfortable with my spirituality, very comfortable with who God is. And honestly, the people from that time, they would all call me heretics. They would all call me, you know, blasphemers, you know, because I don't adhere to what they adhere to. It's taken a long time to get here. And honestly, some of the, you know, I don't know where I'd be now if that didn't happen. In a way, I can't really ask those questions, because one, it's irrelevant, because I can't go back and undo it. And all I can really do is go forward, but it is, I, there are a lot of things that I feel sad about that I did or said or things that happened because we got sent on that path due to this 1 3-day occurrence.
There's so much there. I mean, also like the satanic panic stuff, which we kind of talked on, like that stuff's making like a comeback. I don't know if it ever went away, but I see it more prevalent now in social media with some churches, and that stuff like really like concerns me, because it's the result of that kind of satanic panic is exactly, your story is a perfect example of what it can do to people, especially because it's, I think a lot of it, this is me too talking. I think a lot of it is uninformed and just things we grasp a hold of because of pop culture or because of a guy who wrote a book because he read Revelations and he thinks he knows what it says, when who the hell really knows what Revelations is trying to say?
Exactly. So
it's just whatever. I mean, it's crazy. I do have a question though, because I mean, I know like being now where you are, I mean, what has been helpful for you? What books or resources, what has been helpful to get you to a place to where you feel comfortable in your spirituality and who you are? You're not giving that inner voice of judgment an audience because you're confident in who God made you to be and who you are. Like what has been helpful to kind of get you to that place?
Well, that's actually a very good question. It's fairly complex, probably a couple things. One of the best things though, is that part of who I am is I challenge things. So I look at other religions. I look at other pointing views and I listen to it. I'm willing to allow my beliefs to be challenged. And so, because I feel if I'm right, then I'm right. I'm not going to be swayed by, you know, something that's different. So by opening up and listening to other people and their experiences and being challenged by things, honestly, being challenged is how I feel comfortable, because, you know, this whole idea of the Calvinistic predestination, it wasn't until I was challenged with it that I felt comfortable breaking from it. Being challenged is probably the best way to really do that. I don't have a single source anywhere really, but just allowing myself to be challenged. And honestly, I do this one indulgence. I listen to, there's a very fundamental radio station that's nearby. There are times that I listen to it just simply to say, you know, I have to break from that past. So I listen to it to see if, not all the time, once in a while, I'll turn it on just to see, do I still believe that? Can I face that challenge? Because it's still in the back of my head. These defaults always appear. And so sometimes I have to remind myself where I came from. So I even expose myself to those beliefs I left behind to make sure that I feel like I'm doing the right thing. So I don't even close those doors yet. I still listen to other points of view. And so really, I think allowing myself to be challenged is the way that I keep grounded.
So when Joyce actually reached out to me just to be like, hey, thanks for what you guys are doing, this has like led to like some great conversations for us, and talked about how it was helping you guys to talk about how neurodivergence really played such a big part in your own story and how it potentially even has made you like more susceptible to things than a neurotypical person might be, or differently affected than a neurotypical person might be. And I would love to know a little bit of your thoughts on that, if you're open to talking about that here.
Yeah, sure.
As well as like what you would want to say to somebody else who is neurodivergent, who's in these spaces, who's coming up against like, this doesn't make sense. This isn't logical. You're at a Christian school and you're seeing like the hypocrisy, and you're saying one thing, but you're living one way, or you say that there's one fruit, but there's actually all these fruits. Like, what, you know, that I would love to hear you just speak to that a little bit if you're open to that.
Yeah. So hopefully I can answer that question and not go too far off the topic. Yes, I would say that it did make me more susceptible, not intellectually, but in practice, because in my head, I knew what I thought was right. I knew what made sense to me. But when you're neurodivergent, you're basically told that you're missing things. You don't see things the way and everybody else does. And so you kind of have to go on what other people say. My whole social interaction is based on observation over the years and saying the wrong thing and knowing what happens when I do. And so you learn very much by observation because there's some things that come very easy for me conceptually. I can get, that's why usually on my side of the spectrum, we tend to be very good at certain things. On the other hand, we know too that we have deficiencies. Even when I didn't realize that I was neurodivergent, you still know it. You still know that you're not seeing things that some other people see. So logically, for me, if 99 people are seeing one thing and I'm seeing something different, then maybe I'm seeing it wrong. I have to then take what other people say, which is ironic in and of itself because I'm very self-aware that I don't have to do what other people say. I normally don't. I normally have different positions than other people have. But at the same time, you don't have 100% confidence that you're right. What it does, the way that I would describe it, is it creates a conflict, like in a computer program where a line of code is off and it crashes and it loops or it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. When I have these kinds of conflicts with what I see versus what I see in my head and what's logical to me, that really creates a disturbance within me and an uncomfortableness. And for most things, it's not a big deal. But when you're talking about faith, that's a big deal. That has eternal consequences. When I was assured that I was part of the elect and nothing was going to happen to me, then I based bad decisions off of that. And so to me, that was logical because you can't earn your faith, which, you know, I still believe you don't earn it. So that made sense to me that, okay, well, God says I'm going to heaven, so I don't earn it. So I can't unearn it. So I can just do what I want. And I think with my thought process, just looking at it from that perspective, I was warned, hey, well, you're not going to receive a reward. You're not going to have these crowns in heaven. I was always taught that the more you did for God, the bigger the mansion you're going to have in heaven. And my friend and I even sort of a very dark joke, but we joked, you know, we'll probably be the homeless people in the New Jerusalem, but we'll be there. So it doesn't matter. I think in some ways it does. That in some ways it doesn't, because we can see, and again, I'm speaking for myself, I can see the flaws pretty easily. I have an ability to look at something and take it to its logical conclusion of what can possibly go wrong with this. And I can see a lot of those things, which I call troubleshooting, but I can see a lot of things wrong with that, with those things. But at the same time, then do I have confidence that I'm right? Because I know I'm not right all the time. So it creates a conflict.
It sounds, because I think like even a neurotypical person, when there's 99 people saying you're wrong and you're the one person being like, but am I? Like that is already a conflict, but I can see the extra layers added when you have a consistent weighing going on in almost every area, it sounds like. Like, am I right? Is this right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's just, it's like a whole nother level of weighing things against logic and then against what society is accepting as truth. And I think it's really powerful and important for people to hear your story because, to be honest, as you're talking and explaining how you process and how you exist in this world. One, I think it's beautiful. I love how like diverse and rich the image bearers are and how God really does create us all differently. And I don't feel like it's something wrong with you. I think it's something that God created you with. I also think that there's pretty much no way for someone that processes in the way that you do to comfortably exist in a high control religious space. And so right. I'm thinking, like, if we all care about what it looks like for the church to be the hands and feet of Jesus and to care for others and to be a community, then what does it look like for us to actually make space for people who process like you, who are neurodivergent, who don't process in a typical way? Our churches are fully set up just for pretty much white men, like the mm-hmm. churches I'm talking about, white male, neurotypical processing. Like, what does it look like for us moving forward? And maybe this is just me just saying this. I don't have the answer. I'm not expecting you guys to have some brilliant answer for this. Just as you've been talking, I've been thinking, how do we make the church a space where people that are neurodivergent are able to be there and exist in their space for them, and it's celebrated and welcome? Like, the questions are welcome, and it's viewed as a gift to the body of Christ that, like, we're being given the opportunity to dig deeper into our faith and what we believe.
I think probably the biggest problem is that the way I conceptualize, and again, I don't want to speak for others, but for me, I don't conceptualize verbally. I conceptualize a picture, and I know what that means. And for me to describe it to you, it's very difficult. And like, when people say, do you believe the Bible's inerrant or infallible? I say, those are the wrong questions. I don't see it that way. That I have all these other questions. I have all this other approach to it. And if I try to explain that to somebody, they're probably going to get the wrong idea about what I believe about it, because I really can't explain it to you. But I feel comfortable in it. I feel like I know that. But for me to explain something complex to a neurotypical or even to another neurodiverse individual is extremely difficult. And that's where we all feel, I think we all feel locked in our heads. And that we can't express what we're really thinking, really feeling. And because a lot of people think we don't have emotions or we can't identify them. We know exactly what our emotions are. We just can't describe them to you, because you'll see anger. It's like, that's water. Okay. Anger is water. I don't see water. I see H2O. My emotions I see as various component parts. For me to be able to tell you what that emotion is, I really can't, because I don't see it that way. I see it differently. And so it's very difficult for us to really express what we want. And I think that's where churches need to chill a little bit and allow people to just express themselves and not be, you know, defensive of it, and to really take it for what it is. And if you really feel like you've got the right theology, then you shouldn't be threatened by it. It's a difficult place to be, because you know what you know, but you can't always tell other people what it is. And for me, I have that part of the spectrum that doesn't have a filter. And so I talk and talk and talk. And so it's hard for me to not say something, even though I know this is going to come out wrong and they're going to take it the wrong way. It's going to cause a problem. Sometimes I can't help myself. And so then I feel bad for myself. And then it sort of starts a spiral too, because again, I live in an analytical thought process, and not that I use perfect logic. My logic can be flawed. I can put things together wrong, but I take pieces of what I consider evidence and I put together like a puzzle. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not, but that's how I see it. I'm not intentionally trying to be difficult, but that's just how it is. And you know, I won't say that I've never been rebellious. I've been rebellious. I have been obstinate. I have been annoying. But it just, when I'm being genuine, it can come across that way. It's difficult for neurotypicals to understand. And I don't know what the answer is to that.
I think you actually gave the answer in a lot of that, because I think at least in the spaces that we've come from, John and myself, that there's not a space for diversity of thought or different ways to approach things. which then creates a very strict narrative that is enforced on all people. And you have to fall within those lines. And if you're perceived outside those lines, you're perceived as sinful, unbiblical, whatever you want to throw out there.
A coven leader.
Yeah, a coven leader. Yeah. So I think your answer actually like is very much a wise statement to the church to say, we're getting in our own way because we're limiting the voices that we allow to speak. And that God actually created more diverse voices, not just through people of color, but other types of individuals as well that have different gifts and different abilities that we don't, and we are not allowing those voices to speak. And the reason we're not is because we have this very strict narrative that we have to adhere to, and if we don't adhere to it, then, you know, as we all said, we're in judgment of hell. So I think your wisdom, I think what you said is very wise, and it's almost an invitation to, like, you've done this, like, you're very self-aware. So throughout the conversation, I'm just amazed at how self-aware you are to say, here are my faults. I know I have them. I know I've done these things. These things I did weren't right. But then I also see this differently, and here's how I see it. And to be honest, like, that's very refreshing because we often don't do that. Like, people don't do that. And that's the wisdom in this conversation that I'm taking away, is that your voice is needed and is unique, and the church needs to be willing to ask itself tough questions, to be curious, and to allow other people in the room and listen, and just listen. So, and that's kind of what I took from that answer, but that's me. That's just me. I don't have any other questions for you, Aaron, but I just want to make sure, is there anything else that you would like to kind of talk through or share that you think would be relevant for this?
Well, I guess the last thought I would have is that neurodivergent is seen as problematic. It's something to be dealt with rather than embraced. And I see that in my son. It's very sad to see him being treated in churches as well, where in some environments it's good and just others it's not. So it's viewed as being a problem, not something that's different and actually could bring a new perspective to issues that people can't see eye to eye on anyways.
This was part one of a two-part series featuring both Aaron and Joyce's story. Episode 2, Joyce's Story, is out now, so make sure not to miss it. I'm Jonna Harris, and this has been the Bodies Behind the Bus podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed here are the speaker's own and not those of this podcast. This content is presented for informational and educational purposes that constitute fair use, commentary, or criticism. While we make every effort to ensure that the information shared is accurate, we welcome any comment, suggestion, or correction of errors.